It's time for the Burt Cohen Show. And what has become of the dream for America, the middle class, that a democracy, a republic depends on, is being squeezed out pretty hard. And with the recent election, things look a little bit tough ahead. What can be done about it? What can be done about the deficit? And further, what can be done about, pulling this country in a more progressive direction, certainly more than our current president has done, even though he raised hopes up very, very high. Well, I'm very pleased that our guest on the Burt Cohen Show today is Bob Borisage, founder and president of the Institute for America's Future and co-director of its sister organization, the Campaign for America's Future. The organization was launched by 100 prominent Americans to develop the policies, message, and issue campaigns to help forge an enduring majority for progressive change in America. Well, it has been set back a little bit. Bob Borisage writes widely on political, economic, and national security issues, and he's contributing editor at The Nation magazine and writes for many other places. And he's also founder and board chair of the Progressive Majority, an organization devoted to recruiting and training progressives, real progressives, to run for state and local office. Again, Bob, thanks very much for being with us. And the deficit is something that the new Republican majority is talking quite a bit about. And you have just launched something called the Citizens Commission on Jobs, Deficits, and America's Economic Future. Do people really care? Voters really care about the deficit? I hear incoming Speaker Bob Boehner talking about it quite a bit, but I wonder if they're using that as an excuse to make some real cuts in infrastructure and social programs that Americans, the middle class, has come to depend on, and just using the issue of deficits to better serve, frankly, their corporate masters. Tell us about the Citizens Commission on Jobs, Deficits, and America's Economic Future.
Well, there's no question that incoming Speaker Boehner and the Republican leadership in some ways have done a bait and switch on Americans. The essence of their campaign across the country was an indictment of the Obama administration for not producing jobs. Boehner famously constantly repeating, "Where are the jobs?" And they made the case that the administration had run up deficits and failed to produce any jobs. Now they've come to Washington, and they're not talking about jobs anymore. They're talking about cutting spending cutting taxes on the rich. And it's a very different agenda than the question of where is the jobs. The general Republican position at this point is to cut $100 billion immediately out of domestic spending. Repeal any money that's left in the Recovery Act, in a sense, put America on a path towards austerity. There is no conceivable way this doesn't cost jobs, not create them. It will add to unemployment. It will add to that's already at near 10%, and it will surely have an effect, if any, of slowing the economy and slowing economic growth. And what we've got in Washington is this debate that in some ways has been hijacked by a set of elites who have focused the attention, used the misery of the recession to focus people's attention on the deficit as opposed to the real problem we have. And we have two fundamental problems that the Citizens Commission focuses its attention on. One is the problem of getting the economy to recover, to get out of the worst recession since the Great Depression, and to put people back to work. We've got mass unemployment, over 20 million people in need of full-time work, and an economy that even the conservative head of the Federal Reserve believes is faltering. And if we turn to deficit reduction and cutting spending now, there's a very good chance we'll drive it back into an even deeper recession. And so the Citizens Commission starts by saying, look, focus on jobs first. Let's get people to work. Let's get them to work on doing things that need to be done, but let's get them to work. And so it puts up calls for spending $500 billion a year in the next 2 years on first aiding states and localities so that we don't have debilitating cuts in teachers and the doubling of classroom size and cuts in the police and cuts in vital services, and then rebuilding an infrastructure that is decaying around us and now is increasingly dangerous not only to our competitive health but to our physical health, and then direct public service jobs for those that are the most difficult to employ. Once you get people to work, as you get people to work, you ought to be also facing the longer and more serious and fundamental problem we have, which is you can't simply recover to the old economy because the old economy wasn't working even when it was growing. Wages for most Americans were losing ground. The economy was built on bubbles and debt that couldn't be sustained and wasn't making the investments vital to make this a country, a vibrant manufacturing center, and an economy that worked for working people. So the Commission's second thing is to lay out a strategic sense of long-term investments for a new foundation for an economy that could once again rebuild a prosperous middle class with widely shared prosperity. And that includes investments in green technologies and 21st century infrastructure and research and science and innovation and in education and training. It is folly to say we're going to cut spending bring our budgets into balance and somehow create the basis for a long-term sustainable growth. It simply isn't going to happen. And the analogy I always use is, at the end of World War II, we had debt that was about 120% of our entire economy, 120% debt to GDP. But the leaders of the country didn't look about how do we balance our books. They had to create a new economy coming out of the war. So they did the GI Bill, which educated an entire generation and made American workers and citizens the best educated in the world. They subsidized the conversion of wartime plants to civilian production and helped to create the modern civilian industries that drove the economy. They subsidized housing and began to build the suburbs. A conservative Republican president built the interstate highway system. They sent 2% of GDP a year to Europe in the Marshall Plan to help rebuild Europe and create markets for our goods. They set up the Bretton Woods system, which put shackles on finance and currencies so that the industry would be forced to trade and not to speculate. They did all of the things they thought necessary to create an economy that would work, and they didn't get everything right. Debt kept going up as an absolute number. But they created an economy that built a broad middle class that was the wonder of the world. And by 1980, the debt was down to 32% of GDP and not a problem. Now we have about half the debt in relationship to our economy that they had then. We have about 60% debt to GDP. And yet, instead of asking, what are the things we have to do to create an economy that now can once again recreate a broad middle class and widely shared prosperity, provide opportunity for people across the country, and lift now we have more people in poverty than we've had since the Census Bureau began keeping figures, give people a chance to get out of poverty. Instead of asking those questions, we're talking about how do we balance our accounts. The questions about how you build an economy reflects an American sense of optimism and purpose. The question about how do we balance our accounts is the statement of a timid and divided nation, worried about putting its books in order so that the financial overseers won't punish it. And it's a fundamental mistake about going forward, and the Citizens Commission is designed to challenge that frame of the debate.
We are talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Bob Borisage, founder and president of the Institute for America's Future, who writes regularly for The Nation, Huffington Post, The American Prospect, Washington Post, New York Times, etc. And the deficit is something that certainly, as we can all remember during the campaign, it was put front and center by the now victorious Republicans. But it always seems to me, and having been through a lot of elections myself, people talk about the deficit, but it doesn't generally bring people out of their homes and into the voting booths. And they used it right now, and they seem to be using it even more. There was that the president's commission on the deficit with former Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles suggesting, well, we got to make these drastic cuts to things like Social Security, and they put that front and center. I sense some a politically advantageous reason why those cuts that obviously nobody wants to make were put front and center. What do you make of that whole political strategy of putting that so out front?
Well, I don't think Republicans campaigned on cutting Social Security. I think they campaigned on an economy that didn't work. and they roused their own base with a combination of racial appeals to against a president who wasn't one of them,
right.
with a kind of fake populism about the president bailing out Wall Street and not doing anything for Main Street, and with a concern about the economy not working, that they ran up the deficits and didn't create jobs. It wasn't simply that they ran up the deficits; it was that they did not create jobs, and so they got a mandate to come and create jobs, I believe, and to bring the deficit down. But there's no question that poll after poll after poll shows that voters' priority is to get the economy
jobs.
Moving and to get jobs created. I think that the thing about Social Security is something else entirely. I think the debate in Washington has been really hijacked by a very well-financed elite. Pete Peterson is the lead billionaire in this effort, but there are many others that have always wanted to get Social Security and are using this crisis and the deficits to create the kind of hothouse atmosphere that allows them to put Social Security on the table. The reality is that Social Security hasn't contributed at all to our deficits
right.
or our debt.
Right.
It is a stable program financed for decades out. Any long-term problems it have can be solved within the system, not by raising the retirement age or cutting benefits, but by simply raising the cap so that wealthier people pay the same percentage on their income as poorer people do. So this is not a crisis, and it's not a problem. It is something that an elite, and it's not popular. Every poll shows the vast majority of Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Tea Partiers, want Congress to keep its hands off Social Security and Medicare. But this crisis is being used by an elite to create an elite consensus that this is the time to, quote, unquote, fix Social Security. And the Bowles-Simpson report, which I call the BS Commission, it reflects that in their recommendations.
So is it that they want to get the focus off real deficit-cutting measures and keep the focus off what the government can actually do to get people back to work? It seems like there must be some political strategy there, because they know they're not going to cut Medicare and Social Security. It's not going to happen. There's their extremely popular programs. They're not going to do that. So I think that's an interesting topic.
Well, I hope you're right. I do think that they think that at this moment, as Alice Rivlin said, one of the commissioners, that they think that the ducks are aligned to, quote, fix Social Security. They have a president who looks like he's interested in doing this and has created this deficit commission, appointing Alan Simpson, who has all of his life been a bad man about Social Security, as a co-chair. They have a Republican Congress that seems eager to get rid of America's most successful socialized poverty program, and who have always resented it because it is a public program that both works and is popular and is central to the retirement security of most Americans.
Well,
So I think they think this is the time to make that move. Will it be unpopular? You're damn right it will be, and sure. We'll mobilize a lot of people against it. But I think we're headed into a big fight about it.
My goodness, that would be interesting if we had a real fight about that. I suppose that might bode well for 2012, but I hate to see the damage that'll cause.
Depending on what side the president comes down on.
True, and this president, you just never know. He certainly raised hopes high, and a lot of people are exceedingly disappointed right now. Getting back,
you know, when Bowles Simpson came out with their co-chair report and they called for raising the retirement age in Social Security and cutting benefits for middle class retirees over time to 22% of what they would be by 2050, 22% less than what they would be by 2050. Calls went into the White House to say to the president, he should stand up now and thank them for all their recommendations and say everything should be on the table, but that he wanted to make it clear that on his watch, the retirement age would not be raised and benefits would not be cut in Social Security. And, of course, he was in Indonesia, and the calls went into the White House, and the president got up in Indonesia, and he said he wanted to thank the co-chairs for their service and all of the things they put before the American people. He wants no one to prejudge it. Everybody's got to get over their preconceptions, and I hope the commission looks at these recommendations, takes a good look at them. It said nothing about Social Security. Now, that's the difference between if had he said that he would protect Social Security, he would have gone up, I believe, 10 points in the polls. But not saying it makes you wonder whether he's ready to deal on that.
Wow. One does have to wonder about his cojones or lack thereof. I love what James Carville said about that recently, about if Hillary Clinton lent him one of hers, then he'd have two. But on the deficit cutting, we'll focus on that a little bit, continue to do that. It sounds like some of the things that you're talking about, spend $500 billion to create jobs or something like that. Doesn't that worsen the deficit? And how is Congress going to really consider that? Do you have allies in Congress? You're not a member of Congress, but you work down there.
We'll have legislators, including the Progressive Caucus, advocating it. With Republicans controlling the House, there's no way we'll get it through the House of Representatives. But the point of this is, deficit spending in the short term increases deficits. You could see that with the Obama plan. The point of this is, if you don't put people back to work and get the economy going, then you're going to have high unemployment, high deficits, and great human misery, and an economy that's on the edge or headed back into recession. And if it goes back into recession, the deficits will soar even more. You saw this. You can see that everybody talks about Greece and Ireland. Well, the Irish did austerity before anybody and tried to balance their budget and bring their deficits down. It drove the economy through the floor, and now their deficits are higher than ever because they've had a loss in revenues because lots of people are unemployed, and they've had an increase in expenditures for unemployment insurance and other costs related to food stamps, et cetera, because lots of people are unemployed. And you want to bring deficits down, you've got to get the economy going. The irony of the Bowles-Simpson approach and all of these deficit commissions, which focus on austerity, on cutting spending and raising taxes, the irony of them is they all assume we're going to have 4.3% growth over the next 4 years. And then with their increases of taxes and decreases in spending, they'll bring the budget into balance. But if you start raising taxes now and cutting spending now, you're not going to have that 4% growth. The head of the Federal Reserve is worried we're going to head back into the very slow growth, if not a recession, already. And so go into austerity prematurely, and you erase the growth that provides the assumption that you can get back to a balanced budget. Our spending increases the deficit in the short term. I can tell you that their austerity increases deficits in the medium term.
Deficits. Yes, they are very, very real, and people losing their homes is very real and something that people definitely care quite a bit about. And I find it fascinating. I hadn't heard this before getting ready for today's show, that some of the among the recommendations of the Citizens Commission is a call for moving roughly $2 trillion in idle cash hoards now held by banks and non-financial corporations into productive, job-creating private investments. $2 trillion in idle cash hoards. Could you enlighten us on that?
Well, what's happened over the last year is that corporations have made record profits, even as they have continued to lay off workers. And banks are hoarding cash as they rebuild their balance sheets because they have all this toxic paper, bad mortgages, et cetera, that they have to counter. And the Fed has allowed them essentially to borrow money at virtually nothing from the Federal Reserve, and they could just invest that in Treasury bills and make a return. So you've got a lot of money in the system that's sitting idle. It's sitting idle in part because they're making a lot of money, and in part because there are no customers. They don't see the growth or the consumption that will allow them to induce them to rehire people and to gear up new plants, et cetera. And to the extent companies are investing, they tend to be investing in China and Brazil and emerging markets where there is growth and increasing demand.
Race to the bottom.
And again, if you don't get this economy going, if you don't get people back to work, and this at a time when people have lost about $11 trillion in savings and the values of their homes that they thought they had, they're tightening their belts. They're paying down debts. Companies are not going to put people to work and invest if they don't see the market for it, and that's why the federal government has to step in.
Well, what could the federal government do with that $2 trillion? And each $1 trillion, let me remind people, it's hard to even think about it. $1 trillion is, I believe, 1,000 billion? Is that right?
Yeah.
1,000 billion.
What we try to do is to talk about can we create incentives against hoarding with taxes? Can we create incentives for productive investment? Can we create incentives against short-term speculation, which is another place the cash tends to go, and just kind of trading profits and risks and gambles that end up potentially blowing up the system again? Can you use a combination of tax incentives and then public investments and incentives to get people to invest? Some of this is just putting people to work and creating demand, but some of it is kind of using public procurement and investment in infrastructure and green technology and retrofitting areas, et cetera, to open up markets that then are attractive for real investment and can get investment subsidies for real investment that creates jobs rather than simply sitting idle in bank accounts.
So the big banks now, with all this cash hoard, their incentive now is to keep it as it is because it's making them the most money. So somehow it has to be.
And they're paying out half of it, and half of the money they're making in bonuses.
Yeah, and bonuses.
And you're back to record bonuses on Wall Street. So this system is working well for CEOs and the heads of financial houses. It's not working well for most Americans. And we've got to change the incentive structure so that finance has to go back to doing what it should be doing, which is creating pools of savings that then are invested in productive enterprise, and that businesses have incentives to invest in real job creation rather than in speculation or in hoarding.
So if there was some new government incentive to help provide reason for that money to be steered toward actually producing jobs, of course the scream bloody murder would go up from the Republicans and their corporate masters. How can you tell us where to invest our money? We're making money as it is now. It's none of your business. How is Congress going to react to that?
Well, of course, you have this split. The business community tends to like programs that that actually help it, despite the ideology. But there is no question that you've got a conservative upsurge now in the Congress and these new legislators who are terrorized at their Tea Party base, who may well be find it hard to do anything to get the economy moving and be focused instead on cutting spending and now just keeping tax rates where they are. I think that if the economy slows, continues to slow, as Ben Bernanke thinks it will, yeah, that may sober everybody up a bit.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So the market forces may work against the Tea Party, which has been
the ideologues.
They've been worshiping on the altar of let the big corporations do whatever the heck they want and trust them and not something silly called the common good. We are talking.
You know, it's actually not the Tea Party position so much. I mean, what's interesting to me about this time is if you look at poll, we just did a poll on election eve where we asked a set of kind of longer-term questions to Americans. And Americans are overwhelmingly concerned about the long-term prospects about this economy. They think we are in long-term decline.
Yeah.
They measure that in part by the decline of manufacturing, and they're terrified about what's going to happen to their kids and where they're going to find opportunity.
Right.
And so when we put to them the same crowd that voted Republicans in and they claim to have a conservative mandate from, when we put to them the notion of a five-year strategy to rebuild manufacturing in America, including Buy America, an aggressive trade policy, investment in a variety of areas, that was overwhelmingly popular. Popular among Tea Partiers, popular among independents, popular among swing voters. I think people are looking for a bigger answer strategy for the economy than they're getting from politicians now.
I believe they are. Once again, if the people lead, maybe the leaders will follow. We are talking to Bob Borisage of the Institute for America's Future about what to do with the deficit and spending and what progressives may do. And I find it fascinating that, you know, FDR, one of our greatest presidents, who would probably be called a socialist or worse by today's loose tea, was one of our great presidents. He was starting to make some gains creating employment and building a social safety net in the early 30s. And then came 1937. I heard a speech that he gave on October 31st, 1936 in Madison Square Garden, where he said that, and I think this was interesting, the corporations seemed to have learned their lesson. He said something about that in my first administration, what was then the trusts, I guess they were called, they were called corporations, felt that they met their match. Well, in my second administration, they will meet their master. And the idea was that the interests of the corporations had to be subsumed to the common good. Of course, then came 1937, the corporations wisened up and they kind of played havoc with the New Deal and kind of undid a lot of that. What can you tell us about the lesson of 1937, how it relates to today?
Well, there's a fundamental lesson, which is that Roosevelt was convinced to move, because he thought the economy was on a growth path, to move to cut deficits. And to move towards balancing the budget. At the same time, the Federal Reserve was tightening up the money supply. And the result drove the economy back into a very deep recession that continued really until the mobilization for World War II brought the economy out of recession. And in World War II, then the lid, you know, our focus was on winning the war, and the lid went off the concerns about deficits. So we're running deficits at about 25% of GDP a year, with people buying war bonds to help finance it.
Yes.
And we, of course, went to a full employment, more than full employment economy with everyone fighting abroad and the women drafted to work in the plants and help manufacture the weapons. And so the ultimate military Keynesianism, World War II, finally brought the economy out of out of the recession. But in 1937, it's a direct warning to where we are now. Roosevelt thought he had a growth pattern. It was a much higher level of growth than we have now, and job creation. And so he moved prematurely to austerity, and that economy went back into a deep recession. And we should be very careful now about not missing the lesson of that. We move prematurely into austerity now. We're very likely to drive this economy back into recession, particularly when you look at what's going on across the world.
Yeah, and now we have Spain coming up, too. They maybe need to be bailed out. And I thought it was...
Spain is too big to fail and too big to save, so that's a real problem.
That is a real problem. It's the same with us, too. And, you know, it's clear that the government spending on the war finally ended the Depression. And let's compare some of the deficit that happened during World War II. I want to get back to the Eisenhower years, as you mentioned earlier, which I think is fascinating. Back, Eisenhower was a Republican. Compare the deficit during this huge spending during World War II as compared to now, if you could.
Well, by the end of the war, it's about twice a burden on the economy as it is now. So it's about 120% GDP. That is 120, twice the size. The debt was twice the size of the economy. And now it's about 60% GDP. It's about 60% of the economy. So it's about half the burden today than it was then.
And that we had President Eisenhower. Well, first, you know, of course, directly after the war was President Truman. But the real the GI Bill and the transportation system, this all came under a Republican president. And, you know, I think as time goes on, he appears to be, frankly, one of the better presidents of the 20th century. Is there something Obama could learn from President Eisenhower?
Well, Eisenhower was worried about deficits, as was Truman. But he didn't really have any choice but to create the basis for a functioning civilian economy. And Truman had, you know, after the war, the troops were coming home, whether the government liked it or not. So they had to do the demobilization. They had to figure out where were the jobs for those folks. And they had to act to get it done. So under Eisenhower, he left the top rates on income taxes at their World War II level, which was 90%.
Right.
And he tried to bring the budget into balance as much as he could, even to the point of actually causing a recession at some point in his term. But one of the ways he did that as an old general was he put a lid on military spending and let the military services fight it out under that lid about who got what money. And they had fierce battles between the Navy and the Army and the emerging Air Force about who would get the money, because Eisenhower wouldn't budge on the lid that he put on the defense budget because he knew those guys were rapacious and warned us about the military-industrial complex.
Oh, indeed.
And then he made investments that he thought were vital to the country, like the National Education Defense Act to help build our schools and the interstate highway system.
Yeah.
So despite the fact that he was still dealing with very larger levels of debt than we have today as a percentage of the economy, and was very concerned about annual deficits, he made the investments that he thought were vital to the economy.
And talk about military spending. I find it fascinating that John Galbraith calls deficit peacocks, who, not so much deficit hawks, but peacocks who go around strutting and saying, oh, I'm for cutting the deficit. But when it comes to obsolete and unneeded military spending, they won't touch it. But I know that Barney Frank, who made it through his campaign and back is there, and along with Rod Paul, I believe, have talked about actually doing something to reduce this huge spending on the maintenance of obsolete weapon systems. Wouldn't this, as you said, with General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, putting a cap on military spending, is there any kind of courage in Congress? I suppose that's a silly question.
That may be an oxymoron.
I suppose it is. Well, there must be some people who recognize that, hey, you know, we're spending on this Cold War nonsense. I mean, we have bases all over the world which are expensive, very expensive, and it's completely obsolete and unneeded. Wouldn't that really help cut the deficit? And is Congress, do you see any kind of movement in Congress to actually look at that? Or is this one of those untouchable things? Oh, we can't talk about defense spending. That's sacrosanct.
Well, again, I think the American people are ahead of the politicians on this. They're in poll after poll, when they're given choices, they're much more willing to cut military spending than to cut areas vital to the education of their children or the health of their communities. There is some movement, although not much, in the Congress. Barney created a bipartisan task force that laid out how you could cut $100 billion a year out of the defense budget without while maintaining the most powerful military in the world by far. And he is pushing hard to say that the Democratic position ought to be no cuts in domestic programs unless there are cuts on the defense side. In the commissions that have come out, the Bowles Commission, the BS co-chair's report, did do defense and domestic spending in cuts as an equal percentage. They froze them both for a series of years. Other of the commissions have done more cuts out of the defense than domestic spending. Jan Schakowsky put out a plan that basically adopted the Frank plan, and the Citizens Commission that we just came out with features defense spending. You know, and the reality is the United States spends now about as much as the rest of the world combined on its military. And we are sustaining not simply Cold War weapons that have no enemy, we're sustaining an empire of bases around the world and the assumption that we can police the world, which continues to get us enmeshed in various police actions and wars that are immensely costly. And if we start to reduce that, you can have significant savings with while increasing our security and decreasing the amount we put into wasted military spending. But the politics of it are very difficult. Everybody's worried that in the middle of voting on something, there'll be a terrorist attack and the public will react. Uh-huh. And those who have been championing military cuts will look vulnerable, and the opponents will trumpet that our enemies saw that we were cutting spending and took advantage of some moment of weakness, et cetera, et cetera. And so the politics of actually getting to what everybody, I think, at some level understands, that we ought to be reducing military spending, is very difficult.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that with the unbelievable billions, probably trillions of dollars that we've spent on military welfare through the decades, there we were on September 11, 2001, defenseless. And it didn't seem to deter much of anything. But that's, I suppose, another issue. And I'm concerned about the direction of the Democratic Party. There was a candidate here in New Hampshire, where the program originates, who said, well, I want to cut the deficit, too. We want, 10% freeze across the board. It's this Me Too-ism. It didn't work. It absolutely, he lost hugely. I mean, just tremendous loss. And it does seem that, if you just look at who voted, what happened to the middle class, the Republicans, frankly, seem to have connected a lot better with what's left of the middle class. The Tea Party and the wealthy manipulators of the Tea Party stirred up fears that, once government starts regulating and taxing the rich, the middle class will be next. And now I'm concerned that I read that Steve Israel, one of the more conservative blue dog members of Congress, the conservative so-called centrist wing, is going to head up the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. What can we do to keep the Democrats from thinking that, they need to be just like those guys that won, which, of course, in 2008, the Democrats won a sweeping victory, and I didn't see the Republicans imitating the Democrats. They stuck up for what they felt. Do you see any kind of what do you see in Washington? You're watching this more closely than I am, I'm sure. But how can we reconnect with the middle class, convince them that we, the progressives, are on their side a lot more than the right-wing Tea Party people.
Well, you know, there's an irony in all of the polling on Election Day, which is among Democrats, independents, and swing voters, the sentiment was overwhelming that the two parties should cooperate and that when asked that Obama should compromise rather than just stick on his principles.
Hmm.
But among self-described Republican voters, the sentiment was overwhelming that Republicans should stick with their principles and not cooperate. So it gives them a great deal of leeway. I think you'll see the president trying to reach out to Republicans, as apparently did today, as he met or as he's done over the last couple of weeks, meeting with them. But trying to reach out to them, trying to find areas of agreement where they can compromise. But the key thing, I think, and the lesson that comes from the Clinton years with the Gingrich Congress is he's got to draw bright lines about kind of around fundamental principle. If they go after Social Security, he's got to draw a bright line around defending Social Security and Medicare from onerous cuts. He's got to stand up strong for the health care bill and keep them from gutting it and once again increasing the number of Americans without health care coverage. He's got to stand up strong if they try to gut spending on schools or go back to giving the banks billions of dollars in bonus in the unnecessary benefits to run the student aid, the student grant program. He's got a whole range of areas where if he stands up strong and simply doesn't, you know, isn't prepared to go, exercises his veto pen, exercises his bully pulpit, he can make it very clear who is on what side. And there's no question that Republicans will give him an enormous number of opportunities to do that.
Well, there hasn't been a lot of reason for hope so far on that. It does seem that, you know, he's just he came in on the health care action from a position of compromise. He started in a compromise position, and he seems to be nothing but compromising every chance he gets, doing exactly what the polling of the Republicans said they wanted him to do, give in to the Republicans. And do you have any reason to believe that after this election that the president might find some degree of backbone and see that it actually does help him?
Self-preservation, concentrate the mind. Hopefully he'll learn from the losses, as he looks forward to his strategy, that will help concentrate his will and his mind. I do think, it's not really natural to him. Nature is, as a person, ironically, as a person who brings people together and gains agreement, that's what he's most comfortable doing. I think he believes that there's sort of an elite consensus of reasonable people around these issues that we ought to get agreement. And he would like to be the person who helps make that happen and is most comfortable doing that. So conflict, standing up, drawing a clear line is clearly something that less innate or less natural to him. But I do think his own political self-preservation is probably going to teach him those skills, we hope.
Well, we hope. And certainly one way the president got in there, probably the way, was that four-letter word, hope, that activated progressives, young people in particular. And now, you know, there is the Fox-enthused Tea Party, which is tapped into populist energy. There's yet another story from FDR about, I think he was talking with A. Philip Randolph about some civil rights efforts, and this is back in the 30s. He said, I want to do it. I agree with you. Now make me do it. And I thought that was an interesting lesson that may be used. If people are out in the streets somehow demonstrating literally some actual energy, perhaps that can be a way of making the president do that. But I wonder, Is there any way that you can see, Bob, that progressives can tap into the populist energy, can reconnect with what's left of the middle class? Or is there some other tack that you think would work that we should try?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that we can. I think this Citizens Commission program, calling and focusing on jobs, which is where most Americans are, focusing on protecting Social Security and Medicare from cuts, focusing on how they're educating their children. We're in a situation where millions and millions of Americans are increasingly insecure. They've taken a big hit.
Yes.
They are scared about their futures, and they are looking for who's going to be on their side. And Democrats and the administration made a huge mistake, I believe, when they chose to sustain the Bush policy in relationship to the banks mm-hmm. and rescue them without reorganizing them. And people then saw them as the White House as betraying the mandate they thought that he had,
right.
And going back to politics as usual, where the special interest gets rewarded, and the Main Street, the small business person, the worker, et cetera, gets left out. And I think we can reconnect with that. We represent those interests and those concerns. It's relatively easy to recapture that sensibility. You know, the problem Republicans have is they have a huge conflict between the people who pay for their campaigns and the general interest. They are fueled by and responsive to the worst special and most entrenched special interests in Washington. So, they they got elected, they came to Washington, first thing they talked about doing was rolling back the health care bill because of the insurance agencies. Then mm-hmm. they wanted to roll back financial reform and gut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because of the banks. And then they want to go after any energy legislation because of big oil and big coal. And that's not where the American people are. And we just need to be clear about where we are and let them be clear about where we are, and we'll be fine.
We are talking with Bob Borisage, who is founder and president of the Institute for America's Future and co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, about cutting the deficit and how Democrats can reconnect with the middle class. I've heard it said that really the president has set back liberalism, has set back progressivism by being seen as a liberal, but being weak and slavish to the corporate interests. And that's tough to argue. And I think your point earlier about self-preservation, the president obviously wants to be reelected in 2012. And there's a lot of grumbling amongst the progressives right now. I wonder, is there a way that progressivism, the old word was liberalism, can reassert itself and show some strength once again? Or,
there's no question that we have to be organizing independently and making our own voices heard. And the more we do that, the better the effect in Washington. I do think everybody ought to understand this. There's a very sad, if you will, disjuncture or divide between the perspective in the White House, and to some extent among the leadership in the Congress, the Democratic leadership in the Congress, and the perspective among the Democratic base. And that is, you've been in the Congress for 20 years, you've gotten nothing done, basically. It's been a conservative era. At best, you've been fighting off and stopping horrible things from happening. And suddenly we get a majority in both houses, we elect Barack Obama, and they do this flurry of major legislation, the biggest poverty spending since the 1960s, the biggest spending on new energy and green energy ever, the stripping the banks of these billions of dollars in subsidies that go to them to do student loans, and using that money to do the biggest increase in direct student loan grants since the GI Bill. We can just go on. Passing universal health care, as flawed as it was, finally, after 100 years, getting a bill that will, over time, get every American some kind of coverage. These are extraordinary accomplishments. And in the White House and in the congressional leadership, they are angry. They're bitter. They're just filled with rancor that the American people are not grateful enough for them for all that they've done. Well, when you get step outside the Beltway, of course, everyone is living in the catastrophe of the economic recession. And the fact was, the stimulus plan was the biggest ever, but it wasn't big enough. It didn't. It stopped the free fall of the economy, but it didn't get the economy going and people back to work. And the bailout of the banks was offensive because they weren't reorganized, and now they're back paying themselves million-dollar bonuses, and there's no jobs on Main Street. And the energy bill went nowhere, and the student loan stuff was great, except tuitions were raised and college costs soared far beyond the increase in the Pell Grants, and on and on and on, so that the public feels badly served, that whatever they've done, whatever they think they ought to be complimented for, we're living out here in the ruins, and they don't get it. And to some extent, there is this divide where they don't get it. And they've done more than any Congress has done since the 1960s, and no, it's not even close to being enough. And the crisis is much greater. The ruins that the conservative failures left us. A much deeper hole that we have to dig our way out of.
And going in with an attempt at bipartisanship, not really attacking that, plus having, I think it's fair to criticize the White House's messaging machine, I have to say. They just didn't get the word out there. I want to go to something you wrote that I think is particularly apt for the situation that we're in now, the upcoming 2012 election. Yeah, it's started already. especially here in New Hampshire, I assure you. You say that passion attracts, while cautious positioning too often alienates. How does this contrast with the argument that Democrats should move to the center to win in 2012? I think that's a fascinating statement. Passion attracts, while cautious positioning too often alienates.
Well, I think you saw the classic lesson on the right, where Republicans decided from day one they were going to obstruct everything Obama did, whether it was popular or unpopular, needed or unneeded, in the midst of the worst crisis since the Great Depression. They were going to move to a policy of total obstruction, unending filibusters, unending obstruction, blocked every nominee, every measure, fought against it, etc., and went back to their base and roused their base about this big spending, socialistic, whatever.
Right.
And they got a mobilized conservative base. The Tea Partiers helped. The failure of the economy to recover obviously played a big role. Their base was mobilized. So when the election came, it's not just that 40% of the electorate were self-described conservatives, up from about, I think, 32% or something 2 years earlier, or 4 years earlier in the by-election. It was that independents went dramatically, self-described independents went dramatically to Republicans. But that isn't simply independents changing their mind and becoming conservatives. That's infrequent conservative voters mobilized by the energy of that base, who call themselves independent, coming out and changing the composition of that group that describes themselves as independent. So conservative-leaning independents came out, and liberal-leaning independents were less engaged.
Yeah.
The reverse happened in 06 and 08, where the Democratic base was engaged. Republicans could barely get themselves to defend George Bush after Katrina. And all of the rising Obama electorate, minorities, single women, young people, came out in very large numbers and voted in overwhelming percentages for Democrats. And independents voted for Democrats, not because they had changed their mind and become liberals, but because liberal-leaning independents came out and conservative-leaning independents were less engaged. So I think this notion that I think too many political consultants miss is passion passion, the passion of your base, the passion that you're standing on a set of principles and that, that engages them and that is threatened by the other side, is incredibly important. And it is important not simply for those people who are part of your base, but it's important for the infrequent voters, the people who are not paying attention, the people who are generally disengaged. You know, a passionate base knows the words of the song, and they're prepared to sing the song across the neighborhood fence, on the neighborhood bar, at the workplace. They're arguing their case. And a base that's not passionate, that's either disengaged or tired or discouraged, think about Vilma Hart, the woman in the town meeting, African-American professional, who said to Obama, you know, I'm exhausted at defending your administration.
Yeah,
disappointed and exhausted. Well, that's the Democratic base in this last election compared to the Tea Party mobilization. And you can see why turnout among the Democratic base was down, and independent voters were leaning Republican.
So we got to bridge that enthusiasm gap. Bob Borisaj, if people want to read more of what you've been working on and about the Campaign for America's Future, somehow I suspect there's a website to which you could point us.
Yes, it's www.ourfuture, O-U-R-future, one word, .org, www.ourfuture.org.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today, Bob Borisaj, and we'll check in later as the presidential election comes up quicker than we'd like, probably. Thanks
Look
so much.
To it.
All right, thanks so much. Burt Cohen here. Please email me with your input at burt@theburtcohenshow.com. Thanks very much for listening.
You let nobody turn you round. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Well, don't you let
the policeman
turn you round, turn you round, turn you round. Well, don't
let the policeman
turn you round. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Well, don't let
the politician
turn you round. Slow you down, slow you down. Well, don't let
the politician
slow you down. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land.
Keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land.
Well, don't you let nobody.